diameter. You know, it sounds like a big thing. That thing weighed 25,000 pounds. These launches are 34,000 pounds. So, that's a good comparison. A Starliner by Boeing. That was launched not too long ago. It's only just almost 30,000 pounds. Starliner is going to be another manned mission vehicle to go to the International Space Station. Probably coming up within 6 months. They've gone through all the tests they need to go through. They did try to dock with the International Space Station recently. They had a launch. They had a timing problem with the timer on board the vehicle. Nobody on board, but, you know, this was a test. The goal was to dock with the International Space Station, similar to what SpaceX did with the Dragon crew vehicle back in March. So they, you know, Boeing launched the Starliner as a test, and they got up to altitude, and they realized they ran out of fuel because the timer was off, and the computer kept trying to correct its location. It thought it was, you know, 11 hours in front of its time, and they wound up losing a lot of fuel. But they did have a successful re-entry. They brought it back, and they landed in White Sands, New Mexico. Parachutes worked, everything worked, and they're pretty happy with that. They might just go ahead and do a manned mission without another test to the International Space Station. You know, they felt 90% of their objective was met, so that's the deal with that. Another piece of information is, you know, I'm talking about all these satellites up there. Iridium has been around since the late 1990s. They've had like 65 satellites that they've been using for people to communicate with for decades now. But Iridium has been replaced with Iridium 2, better, smaller, more efficient satellites. Have all been launched, and mostly by SpaceX. And their goal was to bring back all the old ones. They pretty much have done that. There is about, I think, 30 old satellites up there that they need to deorbit at some point. And now they're thinking about putting contracts out to have other companies developing systems to go up, grab a satellite, and somehow bring them back to Earth as a company. And there's a couple of companies, Japanese companies, Lockheed's involved in one of them that would like to be able to do this. And hopefully someday they'll be able to clean up these thousands of satellites that are unused space junk and bring it back. They don't need to have what happened back in 2009 when an Iridium satellite and a Russian Cosmos satellite, I think it was the 225 or 2251 satellite, collided in space. They, you know, it was the first big collision of two satellites. And it created a tremendous amount of debris. You know, these things are both going 17,000 miles an hour, because I think they had 88-minute orbits. And one was at, you know, like 70 degrees, the other one was like almost 90 degrees inclination. So they hit like, you know, one of them T-posed the other one, and created a tremendous amount of debris. And they, oh, this will never happen, you know, space is big. Well, that's what happened back in 2009 with an Iridium satellite. So Iridium's got a good reason to make sure they deorbit all their junk. At the time, the Iridium was active. It was the Cosmos Russian satellite that had used up its lifetime and it was still in orbit. US2N for ID. Any questions, comments for the net? WB2GXM, how are you doing?
Very good, thank you, Paul. I have a question. I had read an article about the space fence that is being enacted or put in place by NASA. Is going to be able to, it's a ground-based radar system, able to track a lot more pieces of space debris than it can now. Will that be able to keep tabs on things such as the debris from these two satellites?
I know they can go down to, I think it's 4 centimeters. That's right now. That's the smallest they can get down to. But they would like to get it down lower. I think the new system would bring it down to 1 centimeter, which is like, you know, 3/8 knots flying through space. They'd like to be able to, you know, refine that. Because even something that small traveling at that speed could create tremendous damage to another satellite or the International Space Station. The space station gets hit with stuff all the time. There's little debris marks all over. There's one case where one of the space shuttle windows was hit with a piece of paint. They figured out it was a piece of paint from an Israeli launch. Israel has launched a couple of satellites, but when they launched, they launched in the western direction. We everybody goes east or north, or south, but they're the only ones that launch west. So when this piece of paint hit the shuttle, the shuttle's going 17,000 miles one way, and the other this piece of paint is going 17,000 miles the other way when it hit the glass of the window, and it actually created a bullseye type of little chip coming, out of this 4-inch thick window. So hopefully they do something. Back to you. I forget your name. I forget your name. WB2GXM, WS2M.
No problem, Paul. The name's Rich. Okay. So I guess the only evidence that it was from the Israeli satellite was the direction this spaceship was going.
Yeah, they were going one way, and naturally the shuttle was going the other way. So, collectively it was like a 30,000 mile an hour hit, But even at 17,000 miles, even a piece of paint chip could do some kind of damage. But you can imagine, let's say, a 3/8 bolt or something. It'd be catastrophic. They need to do something. China, a couple of years ago, decided to launch a rocket and smash it into one of their own satellites as a test to see if they could hit something in space. And they said the debris field on that is like 10 times worse than this Iridium 33 and Cosmos crash that occurred in 2009. There's other pieces up there now flying around. They could hit something else, inside of a couple of decades. If you put all these satellites up there, you could have a catastrophic event. Just, everything get wiped out. If somebody decided to do something like that, you get these rogue states and, what could I do? I think I'll launch another rocket and hit another satellite. wonder what kind of damage that's going to cause. You know, you never know. Back to you, Rich. WB2GXM, WS2M.
Yeah, it's really scary when entire nations don't think. Thank you for the info, Paul. WS2N, WB2GXM.
Yeah, I got that from Carl Sagan, one of his books. He's more worried about, the theory that we're going to get hit with an asteroid or something. You know, an asteroid's going to come in and, you know, take us out like the dinosaurs. And he was what should we do? We should go up there and move these asteroids one way or another, and maybe that'll help. He said, by developing that technology, you could have some rogue state, you know, that's on a suicide mission, and have the same equipment, and just move that asteroid a little bit, and aim at us, you know, take us all to kingdom come, you know. He was more worried about something like that happening. That's in one of his books. And that's where I get that from, George. Any other comments? Rich, by the way. Okay, we'll continue on with the Space Night Report. There's half a dozen people on the space station right now. And two of them are women. And one of them is Christina Koch, and she's been up there since last March. And she'll be coming down in March, and she'll be almost a year in space. So she broke the record recently. There was another woman up there with her now, Jessica Meir. And they've been doing CDAs. Evidently, another astronaut, but at one point in October, they did an EVA to repair one of these sections on the International Space Station where they're replacing batteries. People that don't know, you know, the International Space Station naturally has solar panels. They have these massive batteries. These battery weighs, you know, like 300 pounds. There's 12 of them in each section. And then section after section, so there's like 48 of these batteries on the International Space Station. And as the years went by, these nickel hydrogen batteries are getting to the point where they're worried about them failing, and it was time to replace them. So they got a Japanese company to make lithium ion batteries to replace all of them. So that's what they've been doing for the last couple of years. There's four main areas that these batteries are located on the space station. There's some of the P4 truss section, the P6, and then on the starboard side, this is the S4 and the S6. That's where these batteries are located. Well, they did one section already about a year or so ago, and now they're working on this other section. Last year, they were changing out the batteries. Delivered from a cargo vehicle from Japan. Japan launches their own cargo vehicle to the space station, the HTV they call it, and it carries the most weight out of all the cargo vehicles that we have going up there. And it docked with the space station, and they unloaded all these batteries with this robotic arm. And then eventually you do an EVA to take these massive robotic, massive batteries that weigh hundreds of pounds each. And each one is bigger than the biggest suitcase you could imagine. And they have to bring them along the truss section and eventually plug them into where they go. But before they plug them into where they go, they have to disconnect the old ones, sometimes with the help of the robotic arm. In this process, they found out one of the jumper sections was not working. It was not getting continuity. You know, Houston looks at the telemetry and they said, something's wrong here. They finally figured out what was wrong, and that's why they sent two people to replace this, you know, and get that fixed before they could continue swapping out all these batteries. And those two people was Jessica Meir and Christina Koch. So that was the first two women EVA that they did together. They always go out in pairs. And they made a big deal of that on the news, and right now it's old hat. So they did it again just the other day. The same two people. Now that they've corrected the problem, they went out on EVA to swap out the batteries, and in a couple of days they're going to do it again, do the same thing to replace the batteries. They have two other EVA spacewalkers up there, and Luca Pomitano from the European Space Agency, trained by NASA, and then also Drew Morgan. They'll be going out on another EVA, and this time to do the final completion of the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. If you listen to this net, I probably spent about 3 or 4 nets talking about the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, how it works, what it does. It looks for dark matter. It's essentially a telescope-like item that's massive. It's attached to the International Space Station, as big as a car. And they've been repairing that over the last couple of months. You know, it was in the works to start doing this a couple of years ago because they have these pumps on board, these 4 cooling pumps that keep the alpha magnetic spectrometer cool, and they were failing. In fact, there was only one left. They needed at least one to make this thing operate. So since then, they've bought up all these new pumps. They can't remove the old pumps. It's too hard to get to. So they bought up 4 new ones, and they bolted them to the side of the alpha magnetic spectrometer with all these tubes sticking out of the side of it. Now each has a supply and return, and what they did is they cut up all these old all the old connections, cut them loose from the old pumps, and now they've already tied in the new pumps, and right now they need to charge it, go out and test it, make sure there's no leaks. And this has all happened. I think this is the 4th spacewalk involved in this. First one was to get ready, you know, it's like taking covers off and setting up the workstation, putting certain handrails in that they're going to need to hold when it's cutting something or doing something or tightening something. The next spacewalk was to, cut all the lines.
Another one time
to,
complete.
Set all the pumps, the new pumps, another one to connect all the lines, and so on and so forth. And these are all carbon, it's a carbon dioxide cooling system. And the supply side and return, suction side. And the idea is to keep the alpha magnetic spectrometer at a super cold temperature so that this thing can look at the universe in infrared. I don't know how. I have not did not time this repeater out yet, but so far so good. Anyway, that EVA is coming up very soon as well, and I'll be looking forward to seeing that thing get fixed. And you've got hundreds of scientists that are waiting to see that happen as well. So. That's the story. Any comments or questions, put in that. This is the TechNet, the space portion of that TechNet. Okay, there's a few scientists that actually did a study on all these satellites that we have, spacecraft that we have that have gone and not only passed all the planets heading out of the solar system, including New Horizons, the original Pioneer 10 and 11 missions, Voyager 1 and 2, and these people did a study of how long it would take for these different spacecraft to actually get to a star, another solar system. Everybody thinks, well, they're going to go out and somebody's going to find it. come back here and, you know, maybe eat us or something. But they figured out that it would take, like, the one that would go closest to a star would take 90,000 years. So 90,000 years of lightning then might come within the distance of a possible star system. And when I say here, you know, we're talking about a couple of light years away. So they did some calculations on one actually being sucked into orbit. And, one in, zeros, I think it was like 21 zeros. 10 to the 21st power on how many years it would take. Spacecraft that we sent out to look at Jupiter and Saturn, eventually Pluto, and then you saw functioning satellites like or a spacecraft called Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 sending information back about the outer part of the solar system. You know, humans might not be here when these things eventually make it to another star system. So it's fascinating to think about how big the nearby space is, and that's only to get to the nearest stars. You know, we're talking about something, you know, maybe 10, 20 light years away, you know, at the most. The whole diameter of the Milky Way is, I believe it's around 100,000 light years. So, there you go. One other interesting topic I covered on this net is about India. India tried to land a spacecraft on the moon called the Chandrayaan 2 lander. Chandrayaan 2 spacecraft that had a lander called the Vikram lander, and then it had a rover inside. It was supposed to land on the moon, and it was supposed to drive around, send pictures back. They got pretty far. It had the orbiter, the Chandrayaan 2 went into orbit, and second time India did that with the moon, and it's now their second satellite going around the moon. And then you have the lander, which came close, a mile or so off the surface. Things went wrong. You know, I remember watching this live on TV, you know, on one of the YouTube connections for India. And they were all happy about it until it got that close. And they figured out eventually that it actually crashed onto the moon's surface. It had these thrusters that would be pulsing, and apparently something didn't work out right. And the timing wasn't wrong. And then next thing you know, it crashed into the moon at like 500 miles per hour. But at the time, there was some people thinking, well, maybe they're not going to try it again. It turns out they are going to indirectly try it. You know, not the exact same mission. They're not going to send a orbiter up, but they are going to send the Chandrayaan 3 system up. It's going to have a lander and a rover similar to what they planned on. They think they figured out what went wrong last time, and they think they have a shot at doing it. So they think 2021 they'll be launching another Chandrayaan 3 with their they launch it with their own rockets too. In India they have their own launch vehicles. They have a medium lift vehicle and a heavy lift vehicle, and now they're developing a light lift vehicle as well. So they they go into polar orbit. They go into geosynchronous orbit if they have to, and of course lunar orbit with their vehicles. And you know, there's a lot of countries that are launching things. China, India, of course, the United States, and now European Space Agency is like 19 different countries. countries involved with them in all of last year, 2019. There were probably almost 100 different launches, so, you know, roughly every 3 or 4 days. We can't cover all the launches that happened here, but we try to cover the interesting ones from not only NASA, but India and China and Russia, European Space Agency. India is one of them, and they're growing. I mean, their goal is now, 2021, to land a rover on the moon. That's pretty cool. They have a manned mission program. They've already tested a capsule. They sent it out suborbital a couple of thousand miles out and let it come back very quick, as if it was coming back from the moon, and checked out their heat shield. Everything survived. And they think within a couple of years they should be able to launch at least a two-person crew into Earth orbit, not to the space station, but into Earth orbit, and bring them back safely. And if they do that, it'll only be us, China, and Russia, and now India, that will have a manned space program. They have the program already, but successfully launch people into Earth orbit. And this is WS2N. Any comments or questions? Okay, SpaceX is now working on another structure. And that is not a rocket. They're going to build a structure that completely surrounds Falcon 9 rocket on the on the launch pad, or even a Falcon 9 Heavy. This structure will completely surround it all the way up to the 230-foot level. Each Falcon 9 rocket is 229 feet high, so it'll be higher than that, you know, roughly 240-feet structure that's going to be movable and completely surrounded. The reason they need to do that is they have plans on launching future spy satellites for the NRO, for the United States National Reconnaissance Office, and they require them to be able to encapsulate the whole vehicle, and this way they could bring in their satellite and launch it and load it vertically. Right now everything is arranged on a Falcon rocket horizontally in a horizontal facility 1,500 feet away from where they launch. Now they plan on eventually bringing a rocket out if it's one of these missions for the government that's top secret, and having it completely enclosed and be able to install the satellite like that, similar to what the space shuttle used to do on a regular basis. And these were massive structures. I mean, it could withstand a Category 5 hurricane. So, you know, this is going to cost them, I have no idea what this is going to cost, but it's going to cost them a fortune. I'm sure they don't care, because they'll get their money back from these top secret missions that the United States already sends up. We usually use Atlas V rockets or Delta IV rockets for launching things like that. NASA is willing to give out a contract to a private company such as SpaceX, because, you know, they do have a terrific launch record. So this system will be similar to the shuttle rotating surface structure that they used to have, this rotating system that used to roll into place around the space shuttle. We couldn't even see the space shuttle. Inside the rotating surface structure, you have these doors that open up, very similar looking to the cargo bay doors that open up on the space shuttle. So when it's closed around the space shuttle, those outer doors open up, and then you can open up the cargo bay doors of the space shuttle, and then they would load the whatever payloads they were using at the time into the space shuttle. And they did this for like all of their launches. You know, space shuttle would come out dry, and then they would load everything using this rotating service structure, which since has been destroyed. SpaceX didn't want it. They had two of them, one surrounding Launch Complex 39A, another one around Launch Complex 39B. SpaceX now launches out of 39A, the old shuttle, and Apollo 5 Launch Complex. So that's the deal with that. And that should be completed probably within a couple of years. So they're really moving on. SpaceX has so many innovative things that they've come up with. They're able to catch these fairings that fall out of the sky. You know, fairings go around the top of the vehicle. They've managed to catch one so far, and they plan on eventually being able to do that all the time. They separate from the booster. They come down on parachutes, and they're guided in with GPS, and they come very close to these big boats, these gigantic trawlers they look like. I mean, they've got these arms sticking out of it with this big net. They're able, in one case, they're actually able to catch a half of a fairing coming down from outer space. So very innovative group. Let me drop it. This is WS2M. Goes out to the moon orbit and then comes back around Earth, goes out to the moon orbit and so on and so forth. So it goes a quarter of a million miles away and it comes back close to Earth. And when it comes close to Earth, it gives up all the data, transmits it back to Earth, and then when it goes back out to the moon, with the moon orbit, that never really sees the moon, but it goes out to where the moon orbit is. During those 14 days to get there and back, it's taking pictures of the sky. It's completed one whole hemisphere, the southern hemisphere now, and now it's working on the northern hemisphere. And it's able to find Earth-like planets going around different stars. And it just recently found one planet going around a double star, in orbit around a double star. So I just want to bring you up to date. Tess is still out there, and it's doing very good work. I expect that thing probably will go for many, many years. And then, you know, in the future, you know, NASA's going to take all that information, all the scientists from NASA will take the information, and they'll have another space telescope to actually look at those same planets and try to figure out, maybe there's water on it. This one telescope is the James Webb Space Telescope. It's going to be launched March of next year, 2021. So a little over a year from now, it'll be launched from French Guiana down in South America. And it will take a trip to the L1 position, which is the L2 position, Lagrange point 2, 1 million miles out, and we'll stay at that position, and they'll be able to look at a lot of these planets that Tess is looking at, among other things. They'll be, you know, that's not its main job. James Webb will be looking at, you know, parts of the universe, see back into practically when the universe started, or the solar system anyway started, and the universe 13, but I think the solar system over 13.7 billion years. So I'll be able to look even further back than what Hubble could do. One of the jobs that James Webb Space Telescope will have will be looking for these atmospheres and whatever, like on this one planet called TOI 1338b. It's around 1,300 light years away, but that's the one that has two suns and planet is going around both suns. They'll be able to probably tell you what kind of an atmosphere it has with this infrared telescope called the James Webb. Done. European Space Agency has their telescope that's going to be going to the same location. Also into the L2, Lagrange Point 2 location, and they plan on doing that a year after James Webb in 2022. And that's called the Euclid satellite. And that's going to be this 5,000 pound satellite that they'll send out there to hang out with James Webb. But they'll be using a different rocket than what European Space Agency usually uses. European Space Agency usually uses the Ariane 5 rocket for these type of launches. Ariane 5 is what James Webb Space Telescope will be launched on. And they've had, I think, a little over 70 launches with the latest version of Ariane 5 rocket. And I think 99% successful. I mean, they might have had some problems early on, but in all practicality, they've had like 100% success with the Ariane 5 rocket. But it's still an expensive rocket to build, an expensive rocket to launch. They use liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, and two solid boosters to launch it. They've been developing this other rocket, and it's called the Ariane 6 rocket. And the only difference is it's going to have possibly up to four boosters attached to it. But they found ways with 3D printing and everything to bring down the cost. So they think they could launch it for, you know, like a little over half the price that you can launch an Ariane 5 rocket with. And that's the one the Euclid satellite is going to be launched on. So, and they're going to phase out the Ariane 5 rocket altogether. Any questions or comments before we continue? This is WS2N. Okay, another company I've been watching for many years is Virgin Galactic, owned by Richard Branson. He has the capability of possibly in the near future, like this year, sending paying customers to not orbital space, but suborbital space. And he's got this the Spaceship 2, they call it, design that he's successfully, so far successfully sent to space three times, space being at least 50, in my case, I think it's around 62 miles above. It's above the common line, 62 miles, which is like 100 kilometers up. And he's going to have that capability. He's already sent Spaceship 2 up to that level three times. First two times was with a pilot, co-pilot. And the third time was with an engineer, a woman engineer that he put in the back. She actually got to ride up there with him. And that was like almost a year ago, and they're still working on developing this. But they think they're getting close to eventually bringing this, you know, to the public. One of the first people to actually fly on this as a customer will be Richard Branson himself. He plans on putting himself into this contraption and going uphill and coming back down to get up there. They attach the spaceship, they call it Spaceship 2, to a carrier jet has two fuselage, four jet engines. They give it the name White Knight 2. This was a White Knight 1. That was a propeller job when they had Spaceship 1 years ago. Do the same thing. Spaceship 1 was the first one to actually fly suborbital into space and then repeat. They had to repeat it within, I think, 10 days to win the Ansari Prize, which was like, you know, one of these $10 million prizes. Oh, which they won, and that was one that was called Scale Composite by Richard Branson. Rutan, his last name was Rutan. He turned the company eventually over to Richard Branson with a stock called Virgin Galactic. Launching Spaceship 2. And he launched Spaceship 2, like I said, three times so far. And now he's almost completed another build of, you know, looks exactly like the same one. And he's working on a third one. So I have a picture of, you know, what those look like, and it's different stages of construction. But he will eventually have a fleet of these things. Total of five, and he says if he needs to build more, he will. He's going to launch them in different parts of the world, but he's going to start off in New Mexico, a place called Spaceport America. Spaceport America was built many years ago. They thought they were going to have rockets flying out of there on a regular basis. There have been a few suborbital flights that have flown out of there. The taxpayers paid for this Spaceship, Spaceport America, and Richard Branson, the owner of Virgin Galactic, decided to make his home there. So he's taken over. I think he's already got at least one hangar, and he might eventually need two. But you know, he's got a deal where people are paying $200,000. They'll be going there. For a few days, they're going to learn all the safety things, what's involved, and eventually put on a flight suit and have six people get into this Spaceship 2 vehicle with a pilot and co-pilot, get onto a White Knight with four jets on it, two fuselages, get up to around 40,000 feet, have them drop it, and have this hybrid engine ignite and shoot them up to over 100 kilometers high to officially qualify going into space. Probably getting up over 3,000 miles per hour. And then when it is in space, naturally it has, no air up there, so they're going to have to control themselves with cold gas thrusters. That usually means nitrogen thrusters. And he'll orient himself in a certain way, and he's going to have this plane split. It's like hinged, and the back end will fold over, so, you know, it'll be coming down like a shuttlecock. You know, that back end will take the drag, and then the front end will be, you know, coming down nose first. And eventually when it starts to reach atmosphere, they're able to control the vehicle with, you know, by using atmosphere, the wings will come into play again. This thing will fold itself out of the fold position and, you know, turn into what looks like a straight-looking jet. A straight-looking rocket. You know, it looks like a jet plane, but and eventually come back and land on a runway. And all this will, you know, for around 6 or 7 minutes of weightless space. But according to Richard Branson, you know, the people have lined up to pay that kind of money. He's got like 600 people that have signed up years ago, and they're still waiting to eventually go. Let me drop it. This is WS2X. Okay, there was another contact from the crew at the International Space Station. Contact with Japan. So that was very successful. They call it the Ares program, amateur radio on the International Space Station. And, you know, they've had their Kenwood radios up there for a long time. Sometimes they broke. Sometimes they had to send up another one because it wasn't working right. Well, they you know, that's all in the past now. That's the last 20 years they've been doing that. They decided to go with a more modern Kenwood transceiver. And they got the TMD710GA. I think that's it. Going up to the space station. And eventually they're going to be sending two of them. They've already got one up there. I think the next one that goes up, let's see, will probably be on, I guess on the next Dragon flight, cargo flight that goes up to the space station. Once they have that up there, I think they're going to leave it, you know, in a box for a month before they have a chance to hook it up inside the Columbia module on the International Space Station. But once they do, they'll have a new radio with time with around 50 watts out on either 2 meters or 70 centimeters. You know, they'll be able to work 440. And they'll have different capabilities. They'll have slow scan TV. They have APRS involved with it. So I guess once they activate that, you'll be able to see where the space station is. Should be interesting. This is WS2N. But if you've ever seen that radio, it looks like one of these, like mobile radios where the head comes off. So I guess they'll probably do that. They'll probably, you know, put the main part of the radio in one of their racks. They have racks all throughout the International Space Station. I would imagine the head will probably be located, you know, some accessible point with a microphone. Well, they usually use the headset. They'll probably plug a headset into it. There's a lot of noise on the space station. A lot of fans going on. And they always, when they do an amateur radio contact to the schools, you know, most of the time, as far as I know, they always use a headset so they can hear clearly. And that'll be the way to go. Hopefully they have that installed in a couple of months for future contacts. So they'll have one on Columbus module, and then I think within a few months after that, they're going to send another one up on a Proton rocket, I think, and that will be used by the Russians, and they install that one in the Zarya module. They have all these modules on the International Space Station, like, you know, 16 of them, you know. Different areas that you can go in that's pressurized, 10 main ones. And that's where their setup is. They have four different antennas sticking out of the Zarya module, so no matter which way the space station might be oriented at the time, they always have a clear shot to Earth, make those contacts with their, that they've arranged for Ares. No comments, questions, this is WS2N. Okay, there's been a new astronaut group that has just graduated. When an astronaut is picked, they usually picked out of thousands. And this group was, I think, 18,000 applications that went in. So 2 years ago, they picked these 13 people. Two of them are from Canada. But then they go through training for 2 years, two solid years of training. Everything from physics to going out to the desert, learning how to survive in case your spacecraft gets stuck in the middle of nowhere, and how to fly these things, how to do EVAs. Part of a mission specialist aboard of a lunch. And these people have the possibility of going on to the Orion spacecraft. They're all very young. And when that thing starts launching within the crew, probably within 2 years. And the ultimate goal, of course, for that group is to go to the moon. So it's a possibility that one of these 13 people that are now waiting to actually get a crew assignment, one of the assignments might be another shot on a Soyuz rocket up to the International Space Station. But they're all hoping that they could get, you know, an appointed job with SpaceX on this new Crew Dragon vehicle I was talking about earlier. Or maybe the Boeing Starliner, which will also be able to have four people on a flight. So, good chance that, you know, I mean, there are other astronauts that are flying now and will be flying in the future. But this additional group, they will have a good chance, if all goes right, to get a chance to go into space and do some real work. And it turns out one of the astronauts here is from Baldwin, New York. I mean, you got them from California and, you know, state of Washington. You know, but there is some, one of them from Baldwin, New York, Jasmine Marbell. So who knows? You know, we're here on Long Island, built the LEM, lunar module, landed successfully on the moon 6 times. I say we, you know, maybe some of us are old enough to be part of that way, but, you know, it was done here on Long Island. And sure enough, you never know, we could have the first woman maybe to walk on the moon, Jasmine Marbell from Baldwin, Long Island. Or maybe Mars, you know, again, these people are young enough where, you know, 10, 20 years from now, NASA might be doing a flight to Mars, and you could have one of those people do that, be one of those people to actually walk around on the red planet. I'd like to see that. Any comments or questions? Electron Ion Collider that's now got a contract, multi-billion-dollar contract to be built at Brookhaven Lab, not too far east from me. What they're going to be doing is, they need one of these colliders. This one's going to have electrons that are going to collide into protons, neutrons, and look for answers into the subatomic field. And it's a multi-billion-dollar project, but where are they going to put it? They're going to put it where the old RIC program was, the RHIC, that's the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider. I've been working out there years ago in one of the detector rooms. They needed some work done. I was working with a contractor that did that. And years before that, you know, 10, 15 years before that, they had, you know, another project there, and I was there temporarily as well. And that was called the Isabel Project, which never fired up. I mean, this ring is 2.5 mile diameter, not diameter, 2.5 mile circumference ring, with all these, you know, cryogenically cooled magnets for superconducting electricity flowing through them to, they have virtually no resistance, so they're super duper magnets, and they control the atoms and the protons and things that go flying around in this ring. And originally they called it the Isabel Project, which is tested for intersecting storage accelerator in Bell. And they built it and they realized that the magnets were not good enough at the time. They were unable to get further funding. It was delayed, and by the time it was starting to be developed, other projects around the world were technically more involved, more ahead of the Isabel project. So they went with the RIC program, which was the relativistic heavy ion collider that was successful, and they used that for many, many years. But this is now going to replace it with the electron ion collider. So I know it's not a space topic, but it sure relates to science.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, amazing, I timed out. Very good. So that's pretty much it on that. I think I've come to the end of my topics. A few other ones, but we can always save them for next week. So if nobody else has any comments, we'll end in that a little early, around 15, 20 minutes early. And let me drop and see if anybody has anything to say. This has been WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet. Very good. Well, thank everybody that stood by and listened, and we'll turn the repeater back to normal use. Although it does quit at 12 o'clock, they have a timer on this thing where it shuts it down. So we'll be back here next week. I know tomorrow we have the Club InfoNet on these repeaters. And that's always interesting to see what we're doing with the club, and you don't have to be a club member to sign into that, as well as this net. We'll be back here next week at the same time, 8 o'clock to 12 o'clock. And fall as well. We should have three people on board, myself, AC2GS, and of course, the originator, WK2RIW. 73 for now. And like I always say, go Limoc, go TechNet.
Nice talk, Paul. You had a lot there. Casey, when I see him.
Thank you, the TechNet, Paul. Talk to me too, GX. I'm clear. Have a good night. And I only timed that one. The repeat of light.
What the heck, you know?
Catch you during the week. Hopefully I get on. I should do that more often. Yeah, I get involved into the project. Well, you know how it goes. Catch you later, Sam. KC1SAM, WS2N.
Yeah, 73 is full. I'm usually listening during the week, but I'm always doing stuff. Like now I'm doing stuff, you know. I have it on in the background. Sometimes I jump in. If I hear you, I will. 73, Casey, when I say I'm clear.
Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Time is 12:12 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. 216301410 star 216302410 star 216303410 star 216301071*. *216302410*. *216302410*. 2-1-1-5-9-7-1-0-9-9-6-0-0-3-5-7-0-0-2-8-7-9-8-2-1-0-3-9-0-0-5-0-2-1-2-8-5-9-0-2-6-6-0-3-5-7-0-0-6-7-0-0-3-5-7-0-0-6-7-0-0-5-6-0-3-4-2 star.
Star
Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 2:10 a.m. This is the W2VL repeater. SCOM 7330 version 3.7.1. That time. That time complete. The time is 2:35 a.m. 73 and good night from the W2VL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.